That music has my board op so excited. He's in here clapping along. It's not necessary, you know. It's open lines for 90 minutes here on Issues Etc. We're going to start out hearing from George W. Bush on the issue of religious freedom in the future Iraq. How important is religious freedom in the future of that country to you? Is that an issue? Does it play in any way into your support, your prospective support of the war effort? The war effort goes on, and every day we're challenged, those of us who do support the war effort, challenged from almost every corner for supporting the war effort. People are wondering whether or not the president's rationale has shifted. How important is religious freedom in the future of Iraq to you? If Iraq turns out to be just another Islamic state with some degree of Sharia law, just like many of the other states there, with no religious freedom, will that change your mind on the war? Will you consider what we've been doing there for the last year plus a waste of time, perhaps even a waste of lives? We'll hear from the president here in just a moment, but I want to hear from you as well. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's open lines. Anything you want to talk about during open lines, but I do have a lot laying in front of me. That's just the tip of the iceberg. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Now, without further ado, President Bush was on Tim Russert's Meet the Press. He was the guest of Tim Russert yesterday. And he said that Iraq won't become an Islamic state that oppresses other faiths.
I'm very aware of this basic law they're writing. They're not going to develop that because right here in the Oval Office, I sat down with Mr. Pachachi and Shalabi and Al-Hakim, people from different parts of the country that have made the firm commitment that they want a constitutional eventually written that recognizes minority rights and freedom of religion.
And President Bush also says he recently questioned a Shiite leader about the prospects for religious liberty in Iraq.
I said, you know, I'm a Methodist. What are my chances of success in your country and your vision? And he said it's going to be a free society where you can worship freely. This is a Shia fella. And my only point to you is these people are committed to a pluralistic society.
That was President George W. Bush yesterday on Meet the Press with Tim Russert, answering questions about the prospect of religious freedom in a future Iraq. So how important is that issue for you when it comes to your support of the war, your support of the president's efforts there? If Iraq turns out to be just another Islamic state with little to no religious freedom, will it change your idea, your thoughts on this war? Will you consider it a waste of time, a waste of lives? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And as time goes by, I'd like to get to a few other things here. You may have seen these pictures in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. One, under the heading Hair-Raising Sermon, a Baptist minister that for all the world looks like your typical Baptist minister. Nicely appointed suit, a fashionable tie, looks like a man who's probably in the golden years of life, except you get to the top of his head, and his hair is red on one side and blue on the other, and pulled up into something that the kids call Liberty Spikes. Now, I have no problem with a Baptist minister wearing his hair. However, most of them just wear it slicked back. I have no problem with them wearing their hair however they want to. It's the reason. It's the reason he has his hair done up in this way that I find interesting. He did it in something as a reward to the young people for showing up in Sunday school. He wanted 400 people to show up for Sunday school. 409 did last week. He kept his promise and allowed two of the kids to do his hair up. There's another picture on the jump page of him actually performing a baptism of a new member. This one not in color, but you can see very clearly as he baptizes this new member with the choir looking on, the hair up in the spikes. One of the kids says, it gives me hope because when I'm 70, I still can have cool hair. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And the other picture I'll get to in a second, John Kerry in the pulpit of a Baptist church this weekend in Maine. Kurt is calling from his car. Kurt, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hello, Pastor Wilkins. Thanks for taking my call. I don't mean to change the subject on you here, but last night Channel 2 did a clip on the book written by Rick Warren, I believe, The Purpose-Driven Life.
Yeah.
I know I've heard on there countless times on your show and on AMA 50 that you guys were opposed to that. I just caught bits and pieces of that. They had a couple of different churches on there, and they were saying how people are just, this has really become, you know, people are just on fire over this book. Can you please tell me, I want to go out as a Lutheran and defend AMA 50's perspective on this. Could you please tell me in a nutshell what is wrong or what it is that you guys don't like about that?
Oh, that's a good question. Before I let you go, how did the coverage on Fox 2 of the book and its effect in St. Louis, how'd that strike you? What did you make of it?
I don't know. It seems like people nowadays, so many people are flocking to, you know, to seek out God or religion. Well, to them, it's religion. Really, I look at it as Christianity and God. And they're being misdirected so much. And there were several of them on there, and they just were sucking it up. And I know I listen to May 50 every day, and I get educated about it. I'm just shaking my head thinking, no, there's something wrong about this.
Kurt, thank you very much. First of all, I got to make it clear to everyone that my position on the purpose-driven life is my position. It's not the position of this radio station. We run a disclaimer after every hour making that clear for anyone who wonders about that. And it's not the position of my church body, the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod. I probably could find just as many pastors and lay people who completely disagree with me on this whole issue of the purpose-driven life. In fact, I have found them. They're not hard to find when you start criticizing a sacred cow and poking at it a bit. Why is it so popular? Well, there's I'll give you the human reason, and then I'll give you the theological reason. The human reason is it has been a stroke of marketing genius. I write a book, and I say this book is intended to be used and read one chapter a day over 40 days, not by just individuals, but by entire congregations. Everybody reads the book all at the same time. I even institute a program, 40 days of whatever. In the case of The Purpose-Driven Life, 40 days of purpose. It's a program for congregations to use. I have video connections. I have satellite connections, all sorts of materials there. The book is designed to be read en masse by large groups of people all at once over 40 days. And the promises made in the marketing is that it's going to transform your congregation. Whatever's wrong with the congregation now, when you're done with this, things will all be better because everyone will have found their purpose. The congregation will have found its purpose collectively. Now, think of that in terms of marketing and selling books. If people buy into that, and it doesn't take a great number of congregations to buy into that, and you've got a bestseller. Easily. And when you talk about thousands of congregations worldwide doing 40 days of purpose based upon Rick Warren's purpose-driven life, and they're all buying the book en masse, that accounts for the sales. Now, the theological reason why it's popular, it appeals to our sinful nature. Now, I know that people will spin in their office chairs when they hear this, but it does. The premise of the book, and it is also the reason for my critique of the book, not everything in it is bad. But the foundational premise of the book is that Jesus earned your salvation. He gets you into heaven with what he did for you. But everything else, all the rewards in heaven, they're up to you to earn. Jesus saved you, but he did not earn one single heavenly reward for you. That is not the teaching of Scripture on heavenly rewards. That appeals to our sinful nature, to the basest of our sinful impulses, which is somehow we can earn points, brownie points, smiles, friendship, intimacy with God by our works. It teaches wrongly about the nature of good works, about what really pleases God. Only Jesus pleases God. Those who trust in what Jesus has done, that's the only reason God is pleased. So there's my basic opposition. That's a theological reason why it's wrong. If you want to know more, folks, I have written a review of The Purpose-Driven Life called Purpose-Driven or Forgiveness Given, and it's coming out in the latest edition of the Issues Etc. Journal. I don't know where we are. We have not yet sent any out, So if you call 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172, ask for a free, we'll send it to you absolutely free, edition of the Issues Etc. Journal. In the latest one, there is my review of The Purpose-Driven Life. Let's go to Brady. Brady is calling from St. Louis. Brady, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you very much. Great show. I listen to it every day.
Thank you.
I have had direct contact with an HPV virus in my lifetime. I went to a small Christian college. I had many evangelical Christian friends. And I remember out of 10 of them, 7 of my friends had an STD, an HPV predominantly. And my question is that most of these friends were grew up Christian, all this stuff, but they all said that they had not been presented in a Christian way. And I was wondering what, if of your knowledge, if you have any experience with what the church is doing about this and what, you know, what they're going to do in the future.
It's a good question, Brady, and it is as big a problem as you portray it being. We just talked with Dr. Rudd about that very thing from the Christian Medical Association. It is, he says, if a definition of a plague is a disease that affects a large number of people in a society or a culture, then HPV, human papillomavirus, is a plague, and it's the most easily transmitted, sexually transmitted disease that there is. What is the church doing about it? I don't know what individual churches are doing about it. I know what we're trying to do about it, inform the public about it as well. It strikes me as odd that the young people who you went to college with, Brady, would say, it was never presented to me in a Christian way. And maybe we can blame the culture and Janet Jackson and Justin Timberlake and all these and the people who dance behind them. But maybe the church needs to say, look, this is a reality. We need to deal with the fact that these kids are sexually active and we need to talk to them about what we talked about just a few minutes ago, abstinence. It sounds quaint. It sounds antiquated. It sounds old fashioned. But you know what? It's biblical. The church should have no shame about talking about abstinence, not just for our kids, but for everyone who isn't married. Everyone. The 50-year-old man who has never married, never found the right girl, still living in his mother's basement. Abstinence. That is the scripture's teaching, abstinence outside of marriage, period. It's not only biblical, it's good for society. You can't spread something if you're not spreading it around. I mean, we teach our kids to wash their hands when they come home from school because they've been handling all those germy other kids, and we're so worried about our kid getting the flu, and oh my goodness, here comes the bird flu. Who knows what's going to happen there? And meanwhile, we say to Johnny, who we're more worried that he gets the flu than when Friday night rolls around and he's going out to hook up with some girls, we just say, well, be home by 11. Or actually, that's what my parents used to say. I imagine now 11 would be considered a fascist type of a curfew. What would a normal curfew be nowadays? It couldn't be midnight. 1, 2, be home by dawn. And if you're not home by dawn, at least call us and tell us where you're at. And you say, but you know, your kids are going to go out and get in trouble when you do that. Yeah, but kids these days, have you tried to keep them at home? I mean, if we put any restrictions on them or a tighter curfew than that, you know, we've spent a lot of years just trying to be our kid's friend. We just want to, we're trying to maintain a friendship with the boy. Oh, my goodness. Your kids are not your friends. I love my children with all my heart. Friends don't let friends do a lot of things, but friends do let friends do a lot of things sometimes. Parents shouldn't let children do anything that they know is wrong or will hurt them. Nothing wrong with rules. Boy, where did that come from? Must be from a father of a teenager. It's Open Lines, Issues, etc. Anything you want to talk about. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Willis is calling from Perryville. Hi, Willis.
Good afternoon, Todd. I'd like to speak about this new constitution in Iraq.
Yes.
I hope and pray that they'll permit religious freedom for the Christians also, because we permit the Muslims to have their four places of worship here in the United States, and it's no more than right that let Christians worship over there too.
Willis, how important is the question of religious freedom to you when it comes to your support of this president, your support of the war? The president was on Meet the Press this weekend with Tim Russert. He says he's confident that there will be religious freedom. If there isn't, will that change your thoughts on the war?
Well, I guess we didn't have much choice. The man in charge over there, Saddam Hussein, he was not a very good leader, so we needed to change. So I support the president in the action he took, you know.
All right, Willis, thank you very much. What about the rest of you? He mentioned Saddam Hussein. Interestingly enough, you could be a Christian. You could be a Christian in Saddam Hussein's Iraq. It wasn't easy. It wasn't fun. It would have been harder to be a Shiite in Iraq with Saddam Hussein than it would have been to be a Christian. In fact, who was it? Was it Tariq? No, I'm going to get the name wrong. Tariq Aziz? Was he ambassador, UN foreign minister, something along those lines in Iraq during the Saddam years? He was, at least ostensibly, a Christian. He was of a heretical sect of Christianity, but he was a Christian, a highly placed government official. Now, if we end up with just another Islamic state with virtually no religious freedom, at least in terms of religious freedom, the Iraqi people will be less well, I mean, it's hard to say that, but it's true, less well off than they were under Saddam Hussein in terms of religious freedom. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. So, if that were actually the case, would that change your mind about the endeavor we've been undertaking here in Iraq? Would you consider it, then, a waste of time if we end up with just another Saudi Arabia or just another Syria? How important is the issue of religious freedom in a future Iraq to you? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Now, I mentioned before the picture of the Baptist preacher with the blue and the red hair. He did not do this, strictly speaking, saying, I'll do this if it attracts people into the church. What he did was, he said, look, he would turn over control of his hairdo, I don't know how long, maybe just for a week, to the young people of the congregation if more than 400 people attended Sunday school last week. 409 showed up. He was good on his promise. And if you saw the picture, it was called Liberty Spikes, red and blue. I don't know if it becomes a man of his age. It looks like he's might be in his late 60s or 70s. But I have no problem with him wearing his hair any way he wants to. It's the reason why. Baptist minister multicolored spike style may have looked like it was from another place, but it was made to serve the Lord, says the headline, standing before his flock, poised to perform one of the most sacred rituals of the church. That is, he's going to baptize a new member. There's a picture of that, too, on the jump page. The Reverend Ron Shrum was a picture of solemnity. If you look past the red and blue spikes of hair surrounding his head like a halo dunked in Kool-Aid. One of the parishioners said she was shocked to see her pastor's new do, and that he was planning on baptizing two church members while sporting the unconventional look at the altar. That looked kind of sacrilegious to me, she joked after the service. Nathan Beck, who's 15, whose own red streaks have faded to a bright orange, assisted by his sister Caitlin Beck, 17, they were the ones who actually did the do on the pastor. They used temporary hair color. I'm sure that the pastor's wife is thanking them for using temporary hair color. Beck admired his work on Sunday morning. Not a lock moved while the Reverend preached animatedly about death, heaven, and hell. The siblings didn't think the hairstyle distracted from the sermon. In fact, quote, it might have made it more interesting. Something for you pastors out there to consider. Hairstyle counts. Interesting hair. Interesting hair. The message was even more uplifting for Nathan. The message of the hairdo was for Nathan, the young boy. It gives me hope for when I'm older, he said, because when I'm 70, I can still have cool hair. That is, if you have hair, Nathan. You know that male pattern baldness thing does tend to affect some of us. I was once speaking in front of a group of pastors up in Chicago, and I answered a question that I often get when people meet me in person. The first thing people notice about me when they meet me in person, besides my striking good looks, is the fact that I don't have any hair. Very little. It's actually so short it's hardly visible. And why do you wear your hair that way? And I said, well, it's because one time we did an Open Lines on Issues, etc., where we asked the question, could a pastor be ugly and be the pastor of a growing church? Could he be fat, overweight, with bad hair? And the answer that came from, do you remember this, folks? We had people calling in saying that the reason their church grew is because their pastors were good looking. One lady said even Brad Pitt good looking. Now, I have a hard time thinking of someone better looking than Brad Pitt, but Brad Pitt good looking, and that's why their church was being successful. And I determined that day that I would go from what was a very tight crew cut to a much tighter crew cut. Just being obstinate. Just so that I could make it very clear to anyone who saw me, I was not a church growth pastor. Hair don't count. I don't know. Maybe if my hair were more interesting, my sermons might be more interesting too. Now, here's another story. This also from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. The headline on the front page, Kerry takes Maine, looks toward Bush. Now, if you ignore Beyonce Knowles at the top and turn to the page where the story continues, there is a picture also from a church, a pulpit, a choir, on a big screen, projected on a big screen nonetheless. Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts addressing the members of the Deliverance Evangelistic Church in Richmond, Virginia. He's in the pulpit. This is during a service. I asked about this twice last week. Didn't get but one or two people to bite on it. You look at this and you say, ah, he doesn't belong in their pulpit. He's pro-choice. He's a Democrat. He stands for same-sex unions. A lot. What if it were your pulpit? What if it were the pulpit in your church? And say it wasn't John Kerry, but maybe a pro-life candidate for president in your pulpit. Any problem with that? For some reason, there's an airline pilot in the LA Times. The story came out yesterday. An airline pilot is being questioned because he, on a long flight cross country, he took a survey of the passengers as to who were Christians. He had just been on a mission trip and he was so fired up about it. He just wanted to talk about the experience. He's being questioned by his airlines about this. And we say, well, you know, he shouldn't have been doing that on duty. Here is John Kerry in the pulpit of a church on Sunday morning during the service. I don't hear anyone talking about the separation of church and state when it comes to politicians mounting the pulpit, liberal or conservative. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. When we come back, we'll go straight back to the phones for your questions and your comments. And if time permits, we're going to hear some from a Roman Catholic bishop on the issue of gay marriage. And I'd like to respond, if I could, to Andrew Sullivan's latest In Time magazine, Why the M Word Matters to Me. Andrew Sullivan's argument for gay marriage, has quickly become the norm. I need to respond to it a little later in Open Lines. Stay with us.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Is there anything wrong with preaching that urges unbelievers to make a decision for Christ? Is there anything wrong with preaching that tries to motivate good works in Christians through the preaching of God's commands? What about preaching that contains neither God's commands nor His promises? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for February is called God's No and God's Yes, The Proper Distinction Between Law and Gospel. This book will help you recognize the difference between good preaching and bad preaching. To find out more about God's No and God's Yes, visit our Issues Etc. website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section, or to order the book, call Concordia Publishing House, weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. When you call or write, mention Issues Etc.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. The original monument remains hidden away behind locked doors, but the Ten Commandments are back in the rotunda at the Alabama Judicial Building. Now they're part of a display that includes seven other historical documents. Terry Phillips has the story.
The new display gets the approval of one of last summer's key challengers of the Ten Commandments monument.
I think it's a very tasteful display of some historic documents.
Richard Cohen is president of the Southern Poverty Law Foundation. He says the inclusion of the Ten Commandments in historical context makes it appropriate.
Our laws have had many sources, both secular and non-secular. You know, the Ten Commandments is one of them. And there are many others.
Dr. Mel Glenn of the Foundation for Moral Law was involved last summer in a strong defense of Roy Moore and Alabama's monument. Glenn spoke with Judge Moore about the replacement display.
He did, you know, mention also that it's hypocritical to lock away the monument and yet still you're going to water the Word of God down by surrounding the Ten Commandments with historical or secular items.
Focus on the Family's Tom Menery credits Judge Moore with a strong stand on a vitally important issue, but notes that God is acknowledged in many of our founding documents.
All of them go together to make this country the kind of country that it has been, one founded on the Judeo-Christian moral precepts of the Bible.
As for the return of the Ten Commandments to the rotunda of the Alabama Judicial Building, Menery calls it a victory. For Family News in Focus, I'm Terry Phillips.
The new multi-document display has the support of several Alabama Supreme Court justices, the state's appellate courts, and State Attorney General William Pryor. The acting Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court, Gorman Houston, says he donated money to create the display. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
You can flip a coin to find out whether you qualify for the Earned Income Tax Credit, the EITC, or you can stop guessing and actually find out for sure, because this year we're making it easier than ever to make sense of the EITC. Log on to irs.gov/EITC or call us at 1-800-TAX-1040. That's 1-800-TAX-1040. Or ask your tax preparer. Because when it comes to getting help claiming what you honestly deserve, consider it done.
Issues Etc. is partially underwritten by Concordia Publishing House, publishers of our Book of the Month for February, God's No and God's Yes, the proper distinction between law and gospel. The cost is $9.99 plus shipping and handling. For more information, check out our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. God's No and God's Yes, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February.
I'm very aware of this basic law they're writing. They're not going to develop that because right here in the Oval Office, I sat down with Mr. Pachachi and Shalabi and Ahakim, people from different parts of the country that have made the firm commitment that they want a constitutional eventually written that recognizes minority rights and freedom of religion.
That's President George W. Bush with Tim Russert on Meet the Press on Sunday. He's confident that the future Iraq will have religious freedom, not just a Islamic state with Sharia law where no religious freedom. And the result there will be a better, more freer Iraq. Now, I'd like your answer to this question as we talk about religious freedom. How important is it to you that the future Iraq have full religious freedom? Does it affect your support, your future support of the war effort? Will it have been a waste of time or lives if we end up with just an Islamic state? In fact, if you compare it with the Iraq under Saddam Hussein with less religious freedom than they had before, 505-780-1800-730-2727. Up next, Jim is calling from his car. Jim, welcome.
Hey, how you doing, Todd?
Very well.
Hey, I was listening to your slogan before you went to your break there about talk radio for thinking Christians.
That's right.
And you were talking about, you know, church growth pastors having good-looking hair. Well, you know, I think you might ought to change your slogan to Thinking Radio for Talking Christians, and then you wouldn't have to worry about the church growth movement.
What do you mean by that, Jim?
Well, I mean, you know, if Christians talked as much as you caused them to think, churches would grow.
Thank you very much, Jim.
But I think for Thinking Radio for Talking Christians, in the radio growth movement, if you look at Jeff Schwarz's hair, you guys probably, audience ought to be through the roof.
You're right. He does have very nice hair. He has very nice hair. Thank you very much, Jim. He refers, of course, to my, you know, if the first thing that strikes you when you meet Wilkin is my dashing good looks and lack of hair, when you meet my producer, talk about Brad Pitt. Brad Pitt all over. Really? And the hair. I mean, have you ever seen Jeff with a bad hair day? Have you?
When he had that George Clooney haircut.
Oh, the George Clooney haircut. His wife made him get that. That lasted. He grew that out real fast, didn't he? Yep. She was trying to improve upon perfection, and you can't. You can't. Oh. Oh, by the way, he did go to J school, journalism school at Mizzou, with Brad Pitt. Was he a good student? Was he a nice guy? Oh, you didn't know him. That's a shame. You know, they could have become a team like Affleck and that other guy who everyone forgets. Yeah. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. How different his life could have been. Ken is calling from Carlisle. Ken, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, Pastor.
Hi.
Hey, I have a question. A year or so ago, I heard you talking to a caller about Charles Finney. And I have recently been studying up on this alleged doctrine of entire sanctification or perfectionism. And I was wondering, could you please explain that, what they are actually saying? Explain that to me.
What Finney actually had to say when it came to entire sanctification?
Yeah, and then also, could you tell me what church bodies today hold that view, if any? And could you keep me on the line, because my radio's faded out and I
sure.
can't hear.
No, right? You stay on hold and you'll be able to listen to the response.
Okay, thank you.
Online there. Charles Grandison Finney was a revivalist, Second Great Awakening, who thought that he can improve upon, this is the thumbnail sketch, he thought he could improve upon the method, the means. In fact, he came up with something called new methods for getting a convert. He believed that the task of making a convert, an unbeliever, into a Christian was a simple matter of basically persuading the will of the person. And so, in love and war and the persuasion of will, all is fair. So if you use emotional appeals, enticements, whatever it may be, it was necessary in order to get that person to a point where their will would change. He thought it was just simply a matter of changing a man's will. Now, it stands to reason that if conversion from unbeliever to believer is really not a matter of God working faith in someone through the preaching of Christ and Him crucified, but of simply changing a person's mind about God in general and maybe Christ more specifically, it stands to reason if you hold that view of conversion, you would also hold a view of the Christian life that follows the same pattern. And remember, in the age in which Finney was teaching, it was an age in which the optimism about the human spirit, the human endeavor, the human enterprise, the human will was booming. This was before the First World War, when suddenly everyone realized that we were just as miserable and rotten sinners as we always had been. But this was a time when the nation was being finally populated, when we were connecting the world through railroads, when we had all this kind of stuff going on. All of this was on the cusp. And here is Charles Grandison Finney just taking that optimism about the human spirit and the human will and applying it to matters theological and to the Christian life. Total sanctification. Or complete sanctification. He wasn't the first one to propose this. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, the Wesleyans also proposed something along these lines, what it means to be sanctified, to reach either perfection or near perfection in this life, if one endeavors with all his heart and soul and mind, was considered by them to be a possibility to eliminate sin as a reality in your day-to-day life almost or completely. Was considered the goal of the Christian life. You see, if it's just a matter of persuading the will, and if man is perfectible, then it only stands to reason that if a person is given enough time, the right circumstances, and the right enticements, he can perfect himself. Scripture teaches quite the opposite, in fact, that man is hardly perfectible, not in and of himself. That conversion is not an act of our will, but an act of God's will. That God must create faith in the obstinate, unwilling heart of an unbeliever in order for that person to be a Christian. And when he does so, he changes that person's life. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the person will gradually improve to the point of perfection. No, it means that the person will daily live standing in the grace, that is, the undeserved favor of God, not the deserved favor of God. A person who can perfect himself morally, or almost perfect himself morally, can dispense with grace. I don't need God's undeserved favor any longer, because now I deserve his favor. After all, I've become perfect. If I've become perfect, I deserve God's favor. So I can dispense with grace, God's undeserved favor. Now, what church bodies hold this? I know that a lot of disparate little non-denominational churches hold to this in one form or another. Most of evangelicalism has softened this down to not perfectibility, but just kind of general improvement. General improvement. Kind of the remodeling of the Christian life. They've really lowered the bar there. Old Methodists, the old-style Methodists, not the new ones, but old-style Methodists were very strong on this. Some Baptists. Not Reformed Baptists. And as I said, many non-denominational churches, sometimes they'll go under the title of holiness churches. When you hear people talk about the victorious Christian life, that's very often code for this old Finney style, old Wesley style moral perfectibility. We never, if you can lay down at night, put your head on your pillow and say, you know what, I didn't sin today. You're saying that you went through a day without Jesus, without needing him, that you went through a day where you didn't need grace. You didn't need God's undeserved favor because you deserved his favor that day. And a Christian can never, if a Christian is mindful of what God's word clearly teaches in terms of law and gospel, can never reach the end of the day saying, you know what? I did pretty well on my own without God today. God should be pretty happy with me. I can chalk this one up as a red star day, and maybe tomorrow I might slip, but in the end, I won't have any need for undeserved favor. I'll stand before God deserving everything he gives me. Oh, don't ask God to give you what you deserve. He already gave Jesus Christ what you deserve. Death on a cross. He gives you, by his grace and his forgiveness, founded in Christ's death and resurrection, what you don't deserve. Jerry's calling from South County. Jerry, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yeah, hi. First of all, I heard the report on the Dobson during your commercial there on your show, on your program. Judge Roy Moore's Ten Commandments monuments are back in the courthouse?
Not exactly.
Oh, yeah? What happened? I was thrilled.
The monument that Judge Roy Moore put in is still in storage.
Oh.
What happened was the remainder of the Alabama Supreme Court, which now includes an acting Chief Justice in the place of Judge Roy Moore, decided that they would put a monument. It's actually kind of a, if I'm not mistaken, kind of a mural type of a thing in the Alabama Judicial Building that includes the Ten Commandments depicted in both Hebrew and English, and along with depictions of other lawgivers. The Declaration of Independence, Magna Carta, all these other things.
Okay.
So it's found there kind of similarly to the way it's depicted in the Supreme Court building in Washington, D.C.,
okay.
Not as the foundation, but as one among many foundations. And I would point out in the Supreme Court building of the United States, it's depicted alongside even Muhammad as the foundation for
Muhammad.
Yes, Muhammad's law, too.
Yeah,
yes.
Well. Yep, anyway, we got the ACLU to admit that they are historical and they belong in our courtrooms. I mean in our federal buildings, you know.
But are you satisfied with the fact that you get the very word of God that came straight from the from the mouth of God compared to mere human inventions like the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and the Magna Carta? Those are the words of men.
Yeah.
The Ten Commandments are the words of God.
I know, Todd.
And they're put side by side with one another.
It's another issue, but
no, it's not another. It's Jerry. It's not another issue. It's the issue.
No, I mean another program. What I called about, you asked a question about freedom of worship in Iraq.
Yeah.
And I think that must be a goal for our war with Iraq, because I don't believe our troops and our coalition forces are fighting and dying in Iraq to legitimize Islamic law. And I don't think Islamic law should rule any country in the Middle East, and that's why we're there, and it must be a goal. Another thing, Todd, you know, there's a Pandora's box that's been opened in that part of the world. Because of our war with Iraq, we're finding out Libya has many nukes, Iran has nukes, North Korea, we pretty much knew, they admitted they had nukes, Pakistan are giving a nuke, people are giving nuke secrets away. These are problems that have to be dealt with, and I feel that we must support this president. He's the only one that is tackling this problem. Clinton didn't do a darn thing about it. He had all the rumors and all the intelligence. And I pray that God will bless our president and lead him in the right direction, and under his guidance, under God's guidance. And I just do. We have to help this man. I mean, he is doing something that nobody wants to deal with. Nobody likes him, but that's what happens to people that deal with things that nobody wants to deal with.
All right, Jerry, thank you very much. I don't disagree with everything she had to say, because it's true. If you take on the kind of things that George W. Bush has taken on, you are going to make some big enemies for you. Time will tell whether we can deal with the growing nuclear threat that exists around the world. I would point out to you, by the way, you know why that threat exists? You know where a lot of that technology came from? It came from the last big triumph we had over a oppressive regime, the Soviet Union. And a lot of their secrets got disseminated back in the early 90s to people who are not so nice and not our friends. Never a perfect solution. If you hope for the perfect solution, you will be disappointed, I can guarantee. What about you? How big of an issue for you? Jerry says it has to be a goal. Religious freedom has to be a goal in our war effort and in our nation building in Iraq. What about the rest of you? Is religious freedom for you a deciding factor in the justness of the war with Iraq, in the prudence of the war with Iraq, in the efforts that are ongoing over there? 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Just a reminder, open lines continues after this hour into the first part of the third hour, so we do have some time, and you can give us a call on any subjects. Don't worry about changing the subject. From the Associated Press, hundreds of opponents of same-sex marriage gathered Sunday on Boston Common to show support for a proposal for a constitutional amendment that would define marriage as the union of one man and one woman. People held banners that read, "Let the people vote," "Marriage ancient, sacred," and "Homosexuality is not normal," as they were entertained by live music. Now, one of the speakers at the rally was Boston Archbishop Sean O'Malley. He said that marriage as the union between a man and a woman should be preserved.
If we redefine marriage, I can predict to you that in 10 and 20 years, many more children will be born out of wedlock. Many more divorces will take place. Fewer people will be getting married because we will have weakened the institution of marriage. We need to strengthen marriage.
Now, this is something we're going to hear again and again. That, yes, it's the last line in the sand when it comes to the way we do things politically and legally in the United States, but it's time for a constitutional amendment. Be a constitutional amendment in Massachusetts. That's what he's talking about, Sean O'Malley. Or a constitutional amendment at the federal level. It will be the last door that will bar the redefinition of marriage to include not only gay marriage, but some people are suggesting, the arguments that argue for gay marriage also argue equally well for polygamy or what they're now called polyamory, which means just kind of one guy, one girl, toss in another girl, toss in another guy, marriage by any name. Also, Boston Archbishop Sean O'Malley says that Massachusetts Supreme Court, their ruling legalizing gay marriage is just plain wrong.
For four justices in the Supreme Judicial Court have overstepped their authority in redefining marriage. We believe that the people of Massachusetts have a right to vote to maintain the definition of marriage as the union between a man and a woman.
Now, there's all sorts of things that need to be done here with regard to that. First of all, here in time, I want to get to Andrew Sullivan, why the M word matters to me. A prominent conservative, he's known as a social conservative, but he is also an openly gay man. He writes a nationally syndicated column. He has a column in Time magazine, Why the M Word Matters to Me. A couple months ago, he put forward an argument for gay marriage. That argument has very quickly caught on, and now you will hear it everywhere. I don't know if everyone was reading Sullivan or whether Sullivan was reading somebody else, but it needs a response, and I want to respond to it here in just a moment. If you'd like to give me a call on this issue, gay marriage, what are the Catholic bishops going to do? The ones who are wont to say, you know, if you support abortion as a lawmaker, we won't commune you. What do you think they're going to do when Roman Catholic lawmakers vote in support of gay marriage or its dynamic equivalent, same-sex unions? John Kerry, running for president, says he's a Roman Catholic, says he does not favor gay marriage, but he does favor same-sex unions. Same thing by another name. I wonder how the bishops will see that. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. First, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch has an op-ed piece, What's in a Name? Civil unions themselves are controversial. They're one thing, but to attach the word gay to marriage, and you've got a culture war, says the op-ed piece. Marriage is a basic building block of society and a source of personal fulfillment, and many see it as a sacred institution with religious as well as legal significance. That's why so many Americans are upset by this week's opinion by the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court that gay couples have a right to claim the status of marriage. The court had ruled last year that the state marriage laws discriminated against same-sex couples. A Massachusetts Senate bill would have ended the discrimination, but the court said the bill would still be unconstitutional because it denied marriage status to same-sex unions. The 4-3 court majority said that they would relegate same-sex couples to a caste apart. Quote, the history of our nation has demonstrated that separate is seldom, if ever, equal. Now, the court's analogy is to civil rights. Listen carefully. Listen carefully. The court's analogy to civil rights era has force. When the courts threw out the laws against interracial marriage in the 1960s, they certainly couldn't have created a new category of interracial unions instead of granting marital status. Okay, so far, so good. That's true. When laws against interracial marriage were tossed out, they didn't create a third thing or a second thing, interracial unions. The court stressed that its opinion applies only to civil marriage. Churches can limit marriage ceremonies they perform to whomever they please. No court can or should change that. I'm hearing that a lot lately. People say, look, we're not talking about church marriages. We're just talking about civil marriages. I wonder how long they're going to continue saying that. Andrew Sullivan says the same thing in his column. Don't worry, churches. We're not talking about your marriages. We're not going to touch what you can do. The dissenting judges had a strong argument, too. They said that the pitched battle over who gets to use the M word wasn't that important. It is too insignificant to strike down a law based on what a program is to be called, they said, quoting William Shakespeare, "What's in a name?" A line from Romeo and Juliet. Senator John Kerry supports gay unions and opposes gay marriage. He opposes both the Massachusetts decision and a federal marriage amendment. It would be a mistake, says the op-ed piece in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, to codify one view of marriage in the U.S. Constitution at a time when the views about gay rights are changing rapidly. Their argument here basically is, everything's in flux. This is a bad time to make law. This is a bad time to amend a constitution. Well, maybe it is a bad time. Maybe it's the best time. Maybe this is precisely the reason that the ability to amend the Constitution was put in the thing in the first place because there are times of crisis in which it needs to be amended or clarified. The federal marriage amendment would impose a government definition of marriage on the family. A better and more classically conservative approach is to leave the issue to the states and see how gay union and gay marriage laws work out. That's a brilliant idea. Leave it to the states. Unfortunately, you will not find the op-ed page of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch in favor of doing exactly the same thing with laws regarding abortion. They will not argue for leaving it to the states there. The op-ed piece concludes, a few decades hence, much of the nation may see today's ban on same-sex marriages the way it now views past bans on interracial marriage, just plain wrong. You gotta wonder what the average African American thinks when their skin color is compared to the behavior of homosexuals, which is precisely what the op-ed piece is doing. It is comparing the skin color of African Americans to the behavior of homosexuals. At least it's drawing a parallel between the two. It leads to this question. I just want you to think about it for a moment. The reason it was unjust to prohibit blacks and whites to marry had nothing to do with behavior. It had everything to do with the prejudices against skin color. The reason it is just to prohibit marriage to homosexual couples has everything to do with behavior. Everything. Now, if you want to be patient, when we come back from this break, Andrew Sullivan does a bit of whining about his troubled childhood growing up gay. He said it took him years to figure out he just thought he was awkward. He just thought he was bookish. He just thought he was isolated from his family and others. And then he turned out he was gay. Well, after he figured it out, he says maybe the problem all along has been that maybe the reasons gays have lived this repressed, troubled, depressed lifestyle is because they haven't been allowed to marry. If only, says Andrew Sullivan, homosexuals were permitted to marry, they wouldn't be so troubled. They wouldn't be so isolated. Maybe it has more to do with their behavior and less to do with whether or not they're allowed to marry. I'll respond when we come back. Open Lines continues.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.